It's not easy being evangelical in America, and a lot of people who grow up in the church wind up leaving as adults. There's a kind of stereotype of what that looks like. Michael Warner, for instance, grew up Pentecostal, left the church, came out, became a leading scholar of American literature, and one of the founders of queer theory. He wrote a book called The Trouble with Normal, which made him a public figure in the LGBT community. So here's a guy you would think has left evangelicalism far behind. And yet, when Steve Paulson sat down with him, Warner found some surprising resonances between his former and his current life.
So the big question is, how did you get from there to here?
A long process with several intermediate stages. There are some continuities, mm-hmm. you know. It's a very intensive culture for reading, and I developed an intense concern with interpretation and hermeneutics and the scriptural text that turn out to be real advantages in the business of literary criticism.
Well, so, take me back to the time. So this is when you were a teenager, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So you were a Pentecostalist.
Well, my grandfather was a Southern Baptist preacher, and Southern Baptists do not think highly of Pentecostalists. So we, in fact, got thrown out of a Southern Baptist church when my mother started speaking in tongues. And she went farther and farther into the charismatic Pentecostalist world the older we got and the more unhappy she got in her married life. So, yes, the family sort of moved deep into Pentecostal land. And faith healing, speaking in tongues, being slain in the Spirit, that kind of thing.
That was part of your life, or a big part of your life.
A big part of the life, yeah. Yeah, because it wasn't just Sunday. It was the thing about this world is that it's a sustained commitment, and there would be Bible studies on most days of the week or prayer groups or something going on to try to make that the dominant focus of everyday life.
And was that kind of, did that totally shape your worldview?
Well, obviously not totally, because because it couldn't hold me for very long. But at the time, yes. At the time, it was a very powerful vision of belonging to a world with full-scale commitment and intense community and, you know, all kinds of things that I can look back on and say, oh, yes, there was a real attraction. There was a real lure there. So I understand now in retrospect why I worked so hard to fit in and swallow whatever hesitation I had or doubts. And I learned to, you know, jump and just throw myself into it.
And you went on to Oral Roberts University?
Yes, in fact, yeah. And that may be where my disaffection started, is when I was in a world where it became mandatory. You had to sign a honor pledge at Oral Roberts saying, yes, you spoke in tongues, and so did the faculty, and it was an important part of being there, so that it started to feel policed, and it started to feel sort of artificially sustained, and that's when I realized, well, maybe I don't belong here. Hmm. I went through the whole 4 years. I did the whole thing. Huh. Yeah.
So before that, I mean, before you started becoming disaffected, did you like being a Pentecostalist?
Well, you know, when you're 14, 15, 16, you don't really feel like you have a right to decide whether you like things or not. If that's the way your world is set up, then you're going to do your best to fit in it. And there were certain things that I absolutely liked. I liked the bizarre intellectuality. I mean, people don't think of Pentecostal culture as having intellectuality, but when you're arguing with the church down the road over their interpretation of a particular little verse in the book of Acts, and you think that the whole world depends on reading this verse properly. Yes, I liked that.
What was that verse in the book
of
Acts?
It's the verse from which the word charismatic derives, because the Greek word charisma is used there in the sense of gifts, but the gifts of the Spirit is the full phrase, and the Pentecostalist thinking was that the ability to speak in tongues, and then, you know, different branches of Pentecostals have supplement that with further gifts like faith healing or being slain in the Spirit and so on, but that these are the gifts of the Spirit and that that's what the verse refers to.
Did people kind of argue over what that verse meant back then?
Well, they would argue the whole context for it. Sure, yes, absolutely. And you could be in a small town in North Carolina or Virginia and encounter serious discussion about the meaning of the ancient Greek text. Yes.
Wow.
So I like things like that, and I guess I liked the, in retrospect, it seems to have set a pattern of liking belonging to ecstatic groups, mm-hmm. Of one sort or another.
Hmm. When did you start to realize that you weren't straight?
Oh, when I was at Oral Roberts. And in fact, I was, had a series of relationships which had to be kept very hush-hush with my roommate, for one. And as I say, that's probably when I first realized that there was a high cost to belonging to this world, and maybe it wasn't one that I ought to be paying.
Hmm. Now, you've written about this experience, yeah. and one of the things that was fascinating is, I mean, you describe Jesus as your first boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this...
Which is going to outrage a lot of Christians who are listening to us now.
Well, it's a distinguishing thing about American Protestant Christianity that it thinks specifically about Jesus as a kind of intimate friend. So in a way, I was just being very American in thinking that way.
This wasn't just kind of playing out your personal fantasies here.
No, not at all. Inviting in Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior is the phrase, but that gets fleshed out for a lot of American Christians with an idea of Jesus as a benevolent, comforting, friendly, understanding presence that one needs to be conscious of and open to at all times. So in a way, it's right there in American Protestantism.
And I guess, there's a lot of imagery about Jesus as well. And I mean, you've written about how, I mean, there was one time when C.S. Lewis complained that that the way Jesus often was depicted was
a teenage girl. Yeah. Yeah. Well, even if you look at American depictions of Jesus in the movies, Jeffrey Hunter and so on, you have all of these very strapping, blue-eyed Jesuses. There's a really peculiar kind of racial eroticism to the depiction of Jesus in American religious iconography. So maybe I was just picking up on that.
Do you see parallels, connections between, I don't know, what it meant to be Pentecostalist and then what it later meant to be gay?
Well, absolutely. Having to know that the rest of the world despises you and that you can revalue that and think that you hold on to this truth, that's a key thing. Having a kind of openness to disorganized or ecstatic experience and some language of value for thinking of that as important, that's a common thing.
Ecstatic experience, which is partly about transgression, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Pentecostalists make a lot of noise and fall out all over the room, and it's not exactly an orderly religion, and it's despised by most other branches of Christianity.
So you're saying you're suggesting there's a parallel there.
Absolutely.
Sex.
Absolutely. Well, that's just not original with me. People make the connection between different forms of ecstatic performance with other people, losing control, entering into a different mental state that's not about your conscious control so much, where you open yourself to unpredictable forms of experience. That's a good thing about Pentecostalism, and that's a good thing about queer life. Yes, they have that in common. Although in Pentecostalism, the point is you don't think of this as coming from yourself and from some part of you that is natural and already there in all secular human beings, the way we think about sexuality now. But of course, you don't have to think about sexuality that way either. You can think about this state of being as something that you enter into under special circumstances and with other people, and you don't fully control when that state of being descends on you and how much you abandon yourself to it. It's an interesting and complicated dialectic, getting yourself into a different framework of being so that you control yourself into the state of not being controlled, you see what I mean?
Right.
And so they think about it differently, but a lot of the same dynamics are there.
Hmm. So you are now a literary scholar, which means that basically your bread and butter is criticism, is interpreting texts in
That's
particular.
Right. That's right.
So when you look back at this history you've just been describing, does it lend itself to that kind of interpretation?
Oh, absolutely. I sometimes think when I'm sitting there in a class with Moby Dick And we are mining one of these paragraphs that I know so well for yet another layer of surprise and beauty and strangeness. I think, wow, this is a little like Bible study. But with more openness to the strangeness and the beauty and less concern to get out of it a rule that all of us have to conform to. So it feels like a much freer version of what I learned in my childhood.
Michael Warner is a professor of English literature at Yale University, and he's one of the founders of Queer Theory. Steve Paulson talked with him.